This is Central Time. Now, how well do you know your local landscape, your neighborhood, your community, your local park? For a lot of us, we really only experience a small portion of the place we live, on the paths we travel the most, the roads to and from work, the store, and so on. But we can get something more out of that local landscape with a change of our mindset. That's one goal of something called psychogeography. It's a fancy word. It means, in practice, walking and exploring in a way that's intentionally unintentional. Our next guest is a Wisconsin artist who uses psychogeography as an inspiration for his art, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to go for a regular walk? When you walk, do you have to have a destination in mind, or do you just start wandering? And do you find ways to connect, to observe the places you walk around? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Jeremy Weinberg is a designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. Jeremy, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, tell us more about this concept of psychogeography. What is it?
I kind of think of it like the practice of mapping your thoughts out onto the environment, and then at the same time having the environment mapped onto your thoughts. So it's sort of a two-way street where you're bringing what you have going on internally to bear on the environment, but you're also allowing the environment to directly impact what's going on internally.
And what's some of the history of this idea?
I think the term comes from the Situationists International and a particular person named Guy Debord. But the practice of it and the techniques that it uses have been going on for a long time before that. I think for the Situationists International, it was a way of subverting things like the way that the city was planned out for you to get from point A to point B, and wandering or allowing yourself to drift was a way of getting around how people want you to move through the city. So it was almost like a form of protest for them. But earlier, I think and this is the part that I felt the most drawn to, was the surrealists, who really saw the city as this place of mystery that you dive into and explore and unravel and come up with interesting ways to make work, to make connections that you wouldn't have necessarily made before, to meet interesting people, and to get a level of detail from your surroundings that you don't normally get when you're just kind of stumbling around on your way to work or to the market or what have you.
In just a bit, I want to talk about how this inspires your art. But for people at home who are thinking, okay, this sounds kind of cool, I want to give it a try. You mentioned there are kind of methods, not rules exactly, but psychogeography methods that we can use. If somebody wants to go for that walk, maybe in their own neighborhood or community, how can they get started on this?
Well, it's really about sort of leading with your nose, paying attention to what is in front of you and allowing things that you're seeing to act as clues to cultivate a sense of curiosity, to create a direction or a movement. There's actually this really great quote that I've used when I taught projects that deal with it from an artist named Robert McFarlane. I can read it because
sure.
He just says it so wonderfully that I don't know that I can
go for it. Yeah,
really do too much more in explaining it. But he begins by saying, psychogeography, a beginner's guide. Unfold a street map of London. Place a glass rim down anywhere on the map and draw around its edge. Pick up the map. Go out into the city and walk the circle, keeping as close as you can to the curve. Record the experience as you go in whatever medium you favor: film, photograph, transcript, manuscript, tape, catch the textural runoff of the streets, the graffiti, the branded litter, the snatches of conversation, cut for sign, log the data stream, be alert to happenstances of metaphors, watch for visual rhymes, coincidences, analogies, family resemblances, the changing moods of the street, complete the circle, and the record ends. Walking makes for content, footage for footage.
Now, I think I'm better at getting into that kind of mindset and doing that kind of random walk when I go to a new place. I'm really bad at it close to home, which seems like possibly like a place that would be really ripe for that kind of cool, innovative discovery.
Yeah, I think it works in either way. For me, it's a way to explore a new area and dive deep into it and become familiar with it. But it's also a way to explore familiar areas and to make them new again, to see them differently. And there's all sorts of techniques that people have come up with to sort of do this on familiar territory. One of the surrealist techniques that I think is great is take a map of another city and use it to navigate the city that you're in. So it's a way of sort of making you go or move through something that you're used to moving through in a very different way, and using that as a way to create the stimulus that you don't normally get when you move through that environment. So it's maybe a little different tact when you're familiar with it, because you have to do something to make it different, and to be able to sort of separate you from the everyday mindset that you're used to moving it through, to get into, to be able to see it differently.
We're talking with Wisconsin-based artist and educator Jeremy Weinberg about the creative and emotional benefits of wandering and exploring our familiar environments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this, these kind of random walks, looking at things in a new way, maybe in your own community, or in the early days of COVID, when there wasn't a lot better to do than go for a walk? Did you find new and interesting ways, turning a different way on that street? You turn left instead of right like you usually would. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jeremy Weinberg, a Wisconsin-based artist and educator, about the idea of psychogeography, walking and exploring our environments by following our minds, not our schedules, finding different ways to look at familiar territory, getting inspiration by doing so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an artist, have you found inspiration just by walking around? Have you trained yourself in some ways to seek out some artistic inspiration from a familiar environment? If you like to go for a lot of walks, do you shake things up, break through routine, find random ways to appreciate that local walk? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeremy, a lot of your art is inspired by this psychogeographical mindset. Can you give us a couple examples of what's come out of that?
Sure. The last piece, I think, that that I spent a lot of time in that sort of state of mind at, had to do with Lake Winnebago. And my mother-in-law has a house on Lake Winnebago, so we spend a lot of time there and have been going there repeatedly over the last, since I've been in Wisconsin, so like the last 15 years. And I wanted to make a piece that dealt with this particular place, but I wanted to bring in some other viewpoints. So I asked people that went to school there, that lived there, for some video documents or photo documents that they might have taken of the place that have stood out to them. And then I sort of threw those together with some of my own video documents that I'd taken over the years, and created this video installation where a lot of these points of view were kind of mixed up and projected in a space that was at the University of Oshkosh, which is in University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, at the Alan Preeb Gallery, and that was last fall. So the thing I think that that really made it interesting to me was that all of the projections that were happening in the room were bounced around by a lot of reflective material that was also hanging in the room. So it's sort of hard to describe. But essentially, you're walking into a space that's located nearby the lake shore, and you're having images of the lake sort of bouncing all around you. So for people that live on the lake or by the lake or have to deal with things that are particular to Lake Winnebago, like the lake flies and things like that, it was a different way to experience it from how they're used to doing. So my hope was that, you know, people would be able to sort of come out of it seeing things a little differently than they're used to. So that's one of them. I have a few other projects too that about other places that I've been interested in, but a lot of them are relatively local.
And do you have kind of eureka moments? You're out there, you're walking, you're trying to do this sort of psychogeography type observation. How do things like sort of gradually build up, or do you have aha moments where you're like, aha, I could do this inspired by this part of the environment?
I think really for me, what I have are the like a thousand little aesthetic moments that I do the best I can to document, either by taking a video or a photo or by doing a drawing or just like trying to make a memory that stays around long enough that I can, you know, somehow work it in. But for me, it's an aesthetic experience that usually is what draws my attention. You know, one of the things I remember particularly after moving here and doing walks like this that I wasn't prepared for was stumbling across some of the Native American effigy mounds and not knowing anything about that because I grew up in another part of the country. So to me, that was just mind-blowing that there are these things that I stumbled across that, you know, were from thousands of years ago that cultures that had nothing to do with the city built, and here they are in this particular neighborhood.
Even if we're not going to make art based on our observations, I've seen people make a case for the benefits, our emotional well-being, our connection to our surroundings. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that allows you to do is just like read a level of complexity into a place, almost like the kind of complexity that you might like read into another person that you meet. You get a sense of a particular mood of a place, and you can sort of have a conversation with it by just looking at the way, you know, the plants are growing around each other, looking at how, like, you know, there may be paths that have been worn into a particular park where people go off of the walkways and make their own walkways and what happens there and following those and seeing where they go instead, or finding traces of animals or people's dogs or discarded clothing that might have been left somewhere that, you know, there's got to be some kind of story behind. So for me, like, this is all like just a deeper experience of a place. And for places that you're visiting regularly, I feel like it's like getting to know an elder or somebody that you know, has been around for a long time, and realizing that there's this a depth to their experiences and that you can learn a lot from them.
Yeah, and the time element. The Lake Winnebago thing you mentioned, getting older pictures and images from there, and just the idea of going to the same place again and again and seeing how it can change, maybe just through the seasons, adds a lot of depth.
Yeah, and so like one place that I feel like I like to haunt is in Madison. It's a park in the Vilas neighborhood, Bear Mound Park. which is the first place that I stumbled on an effigy mound. But there's also these beautiful old oak trees there. And going there different times of years, you see different things. There's not only the leaves changing, but I've seen, you know, all of these milkweed pods like open up and mm-hmm. create these like flows of all this white fluffy material that just, when you sort of put yourself in like an insect point of view, moving through all of that, it's like being in a whole nother world. But it's just this little, you know, one block circle. But inside of that circle, there's just this whole microcosm of not only like all these natural things, but this like level of cultural history that goes back like thousands of years. To me, it's just a fascinating place.
And just our last half a minute or so, leave us with some inspiration for somebody who says, yeah, I want to try this. One quick thing they might do after they turn off the radio.
So I think just going out and spinning yourself around and opening your eyes up and following that first thing that you see is a good way to start. You know, if you have the opportunity to go someplace new, I feel like it's a little bit easier because everything is kind of something to jump into. But there's always new things around you if you just try to shift your perspective a little bit and see it from a different angle.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jeremy Weinberg, designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. He joined us to talk about the art of psychogeography, finding inspiration by wandering and exploring around the places we live and beyond. First, this is a popular time of year for motorcycle trips here in Wisconsin, and it's a great time to make sure that the roads are as safe as possible for those trips. Wisconsin is the sixth most dangerous state for motorcyclists to drive in. That's according to a study this year using National Highway Traffic Safety Administration data. Nearly 15% of all fatal crashes in Wisconsin involve motorcycles. And this year, the State Department of Transportation says fatal motorcycle crashes are up nearly a third compared to last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you ride a motorcycle, what do you do to stay safe? Do you have a message for other road users, things that worry you when you're on the road? Are you noticing more dangerous motorcycling conditions in your area? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick Jarmus is a public affairs director for AAA. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
I know numbers can go up and down with things like traffic fatalities. What have you been seeing in recent years, Nick, when it comes to motorcycle safety in Wisconsin?
Well, not just motorcycle safety, but we've been seeing a lot of very troubling trends with traffic safety across the board, particularly with more vulnerable road users like pedestrians and cyclists. And I would put motorcyclists in that category as well, because, you know, you're a road user that doesn't have the protection of the vehicle and the crash protections of a passenger vehicle around them. So that does leave them more vulnerable to injuries and fatalities when crashes occur.
One study we saw here, this was published in Forbes, says that a third of all motorcycle accidents involve riders without a valid license. Now, that's nationwide. Can you talk about, why motorcyclists have their own unique special licenses, the kind of training that goes into a two-wheeled vehicle on the roads as opposed to the four-wheeled kind?
Well, there are certainly, traffic laws that apply to everyone, regardless of what mode of transportation you're using. You know, if you're a cyclist or a motorcyclist or a automobile driver, there are specific laws, specific rules and tips that need to be kept in mind when you're, a cyclist or a motorcycle rider, because you're more vulnerable to injuries and fatalities when crashes occur. There are certain things that you need to know, but that certainly doesn't mean that this is a conversation that is just of concern to motorcycle mm-hmm. riders. I mean, everyone who's on the road has a shared responsibility to make sure that everyone else is safe and that they are not endangering anyone else. So auto drivers also need to be taking responsibility for other people that are sharing the road with them. and recognizing that they have, sort of a disproportionate responsibility, because if they were to make a mistake that injures a motorcyclist or a bicyclist or a pedestrian, there's a greater chance that that's going to lead to greater injuries. And so you have to watch out for them, and pay special mind for them.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. The all the other road users, what kind of things do we need to be aware of to make sure that our, fellow road users on motorcycles are safe, that we don't endanger them through our actions?
Well, certainly, the basic things like staying focused on the road, not being distracted by your smartphone or anything else inside or outside of the vehicle. As the driver, you have to take responsibility and manage what's happening on the road. One of the really troubling things that we see is as more and more passenger vehicles are getting equipped with advanced driver safety systems, the auto braking or lane keeping assists or things like that, there is a danger for people to develop a false sense of security and over rely on those systems, and not have a full appreciation for the limitations of those systems. We've done a lot of studies that show what those limitations are, and that's it's not for the purpose of discouraging, the development or discouraging the requirements, to implement these systems. But just so that people understand, particularly, we haven't looked at motorcyclists specifically, but we have looked at bicyclists and pedestrians. And we know that the sensors that these automatic backup alarms or lane keeping assistance, alerts are not, just simply not able to capture pedestrians and cyclists. So, you may move into a lane and it doesn't alert you that there's a motorcyclist in the next lane because that's not a big enough vehicle to trigger the alarm. And so you need to be aware of that this is a secondary safety system, and you as the driver still have the primary responsibility to visually check those lanes, visually be scanning yourself and not relying on the sensors.
So that basic driver's ed thing we got, check your blind spot before the lane change, still applies even if we have that blind spot warning device in the car.
Absolutely. And the other kind of thing that we have a lot of concerns, and I know a lot in the cycling community have concern about are, just the increasing size and weight issues with passenger vehicles today. They're, especially electric, EVs are much heavier. And then you have, the continued popularity of pickup trucks and SUVs that have higher hoods on them, and which actually put pedestrians or people at a greater risk because the sight lines are different or limited. You're not able to see things that are maybe right in front of you. And then the weight of the vehicle is disproportionately higher in a position where it's going to cause more damage to a cyclist or a motorcyclist.
Talking to Nick Jarmus with AAA, looking at motorcycle safety in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your personal experiences, your thoughts, your questions about motorcycle safety, what we can all do to help. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Scott is with us in Plymouth. Scott, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Great conversation. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to give a little bit of history. I'm 55. I've probably been riding motorcycles for 40 plus of those years. Motocross, street bikes, scooters, electric vehicles, etc. To tell the truth, my biggest fear and the biggest thing I've noticed probably within the last decade is distracted driving. It's to the point where having people wander over the center line because they're looking at their phones, that scares me more than anything, to the point I want to not ride anymore. Being an older gentleman as well, I always wear my safety gear. I've taken safety courses, which I think a lot of people should do. And as your guest brought up, distracted driving, I think it personally is a huge, huge thing. And on just to tag on to that a little bit, some of the people, if they aren't taking safety courses, they should try to get a vehicle that they can control. Something big like a Harley-Davidson for somebody who's very small, I think is very physically demanding and hard to control when you have to do something. Thanks for taking my call. I'll take it off here.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Nick, Scott gave us two big topic areas there. You had touched on this already a bit. Distracted driving as a threat, Scott says that he's seen grow over the years as a longtime motorcyclist. You at AAA, I know, are very concerned about distracted driving these days.
Yeah, it's been a high, topic for a high priority topic for us for a long time. We've done a lot of research in the last decade to try and understand it better and to try and figure out how what's the best way to address it. And the thing is, it's a really insidious problem because it's difficult to track. It's difficult to quantify and monitor. You know, it's not like it with drug or alcohol impairment where you can administer a blood test, you know, in the event of a crash and find out, okay, was the driver, you know, did they have drugs or alcohol in their system? With distraction, there's no way of knowing. You kind of have to piece it together through clues to figure out. But there's just also a lot of misunderstanding of how much of a distraction or what tasks really cause dangerous levels of distraction. We hear a lot of people, you know, say, well, I would never text. I would never be like reading, you know, looking at my phone or scrolling through my phone. Or you even hear about, you know, handheld phone versus, you know, put it on speaker. But most of the research that's out there shows even speakerphone conversations can be dangerously distracting. And it causes a phenomenon known as inattention blindness, where even though your hands are on the wheel, even though your eyes are straight ahead and are theoretically seeing things, your brain is not processing those things because it is distracted by the conversation. And then because it's not processing those things, you're not able to react to them.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. I think our next caller may touch a little on Scott's second point, too, on safety. Matt joins us in Stevens Point. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
I've been an avid motorcycle rider for about 30 years, since I was a pretty young kid. And 20 years ago, I was involved in an accident and from a distracted driver in a construction zone. And it wasn't fun, and I'm glad that I lived through it. And what I took away from it and my fellow ride or friends that ride with me is just assume that everyone else on the road doesn't see you, that they do not know that you're there at all times, that as a motorcycle rider, you need to drive very defensively when you're going down the road and just assume that they don't see you.
I gotcha. Matt, I'm glad you survived it too. Thank you so much for calling in. Nick, that kind of extra defensive driving on a motorcycle.
Yeah, that idea of defensive driving is key because, you know, we know no matter how safe of a driver you may be, you still also can be affected by the mistakes of others. And so being able to anticipate those, you know, being conscious of what other drivers on the road are doing. If you see a driver that's sharing the road with you is distracted or seems to possibly be impaired or something, knowing what to do. And usually the best thing to do is to slow down, move out of their way, let them pass by so that you keep them in front of you and you can monitor what they're doing instead of you having to worry about what they're doing behind you. But that's, of course, not always possible. And certainly that still leaves that person on the road to cause, you know, risk to other people. You know, if you are able to pull safely off the side of the road, you know, call emergency authorities, give them your location and a description of the vehicle, and see if they can dispatch someone to try and get that driver off the road. That's ideal because that's going to keep everyone safe.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt. We're talking to Nick Jarmus, Public Affairs Director for AAA. We're talking about motorcycle safety, what bikers need to know, and all the other road users need to know to keep everybody safe. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you ride a motorcycle yourself, what are some of the riskiest things you see out there? Are you getting out on your bike a lot this year? Have you seen things change over the last few years when it comes to safety and attentive driving? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Nick Jarmus, Public Affairs Director at AAA. We're looking into a rise in Wisconsin motorcycle fatalities this year and how to stay safe on the road. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Do you wear helmets when on a motorcycle? How can the state better protect bikers on the road? Join in with your thoughts, experiences, or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Marinette. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm 63, had a license since I was 17. One accident, broke 26 bones, was brought by an elderly gentleman. Otherwise, pretty good record. Just wanted to say, people, to add on to what another guy said on your show, people should drive like, pretend like you're invisible. Like, nobody can even see you. A mentor of mine told me that, and to me it works.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, we've had a few comments from motorcyclists now on how to ride safely and defensively. And Scott, our first call, mentioned safety training. Now, what kind of things go into safety training for those motorcyclists? Are there things that we could do to enhance that training?
Well, certainly. I mean, there are the drivers or rider safety courses that are offered through DOT, the Wisconsin Motorcycle Safety Program. We recommend everyone go through those, making sure you referenced at the top, the percentage of these fatalities that involve a driver who is not properly licensed. And that really, is again, an issue that cuts across everyone. I mean, we know that there's a certain percentage of all crashes that involve non-licensed drivers or drivers at least who have had their license revoked. And that proper training, proper preparation is really key for anyone that's going to be out on the road, even cyclists, even pedestrians. If you're going to be in that roadway environment, you need to know what your individual responsibilities are, how to keep yourself safe, as well as how to keep other people safe. And that's really what I would want to stress more than anything, is that shared sense of responsibility. Because a lot of drivers, maybe dismiss like, well, if you're on a motorcyclist, you're taking that risk on, and that's on you. And that's really not the right way to look at it. Everyone needs to be watching out for themselves as well as watching out for everyone else, because we all just want to get home. And everyone that's on the road is a friend or a family member of someone out there, an important life that needs to be preserved and protected on the road.
Jim, thanks for the call. Chris is with us now in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to say how I drive like about 25,000 miles a year, and I don't know how valid this is, but there seems to be this perception that like motorcycle drivers tend to be kind of aggressive, and I've kind of, it's probably confirmation bias, but I was kind of just wondering, as far as that whole stereotype goes, what is that warranted? Are there statistics on that, and so on and so forth? And that's pretty much all I was asking.
Hey, Chris, I want to ask you, it sounds like if that's a stereotype out there, you don't see yourself that way. You don't see yourself as a aggressive, risk-taking kind of motorcyclist. Do I have that right?
No, I'm not a motorcyclist. I just drive a car to work.
Oh, car. I
commute 50 miles one way. Yeah, and, I think everybody's seen, that guy on a motorcycle that, whizzes past or, rides you. And, I'm open-minded. I think maybe that's just confirmation bias. But I was just wondering, does anybody have the facts?
Gotcha. Chris, thanks for the call. Nick, anything to suggest that motorcyclists are any more aggressive as drivers than other drivers?
No, I do think that's more of a perception thing. And I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but, we do know that motorcyclists and other vulnerable roadway users are disproportionately overrepresented in crash fatalities, but that's largely a function of the fact that they're less protected by, the vehicle around them. And that's why they are vulnerable roadway users. I don't necessarily think it's the case that motorcyclists are involved in a disproportionate number of crashes. Generally, it's just that when those crashes occur, they tend to be more injury causing for them. So I think that is more of a perception thing. And we know most motorcyclists are not primarily motorcyclists. They also are drivers. Same thing with cyclists and pedestrians. Most people are multimodal to some extent. They're never using one mode of transportation exclusively 100% of the time. And so everyone needs to, remember that, the cyclists and motorcyclists that are out there have every right to be out there as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Nick Jarmus from AAA about motorcycle safety in a peak motorcycle season this time of year. Back to your calls. Nick is with us in Madison. Nick, hi.
Hi. I've been commuting and driving for my careers forever, and so I see a lot of stuff on the road. And I just got to say, you know, motorcycle, obviously you don't have the protection of a car, and people choose not to wear a helmet, whatever. And there are some bad drivers out there, and worse and worse. So I think, you know, it, just one point is, it's, you know, it's a dangerous thing. I mean, anyway, another point is, I've seen, you know, in the Beltline, back up on the Beltline in the morning, you know, little crotch rockets and whatnot shooting up in between, you know, the two lanes. So I think, you know, motorcycles got to police their own also, because
yeah, Nick, I gotcha. We don't have a ton of time left. Nick, Jarmus, first of all, that last thing he mentioned, when motorcycles go through that stopped traffic on, say, a highway somewhere, I think that's legal, but correct me if I'm wrong.
You know, I'm not 100% sure. Okay. It is legal in some jurisdictions, you know, not legal in others. It does present a lot of risk. And so, you know, this is just kind of a general statement as well. Just because something is legal or is not illegal doesn't make it a safe and smart thing to do. And so, I mean, I think I would discourage motorcyclists from doing that, even if it were legal, just for a number of reasons. But yeah, it's that is a complaint that we do hear often, that is a unnecessary risk.
Thanks for that call. I'm looking, Nick, at a stat here. About a quarter of motorcycle accident deaths, this is nationwide here, in the last couple of years, involved alcohol. Now, that could be the motorcyclist. It could be another driver in a collision. May seem obvious, but avoiding alcohol while driving, still a big deal for all users.
That's right. And that's actually about on par with what, you know, all roadway crashes involve. You know, about a third of them actually involve alcohol to some extent. So no matter what mode of transportation you're using, just don't get behind the wheel if you're impaired, you know, even if you've had a little bit of drinks. And Wisconsin is great in the sense there are a lot of alternatives out there. You know, we have the Safe Ride program. We offer our Tow2Go program during key holiday weekends. There's a lot of other ways that you can get home. There's really no excuse for ever getting on your bike or behind the wheel if you are impaired.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Nick Jarmus, Director of Public Affairs for AAA. You can keep the conversation about motorcycle safety going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you are seeing out there on the road, whatever you're driving, what you do to try to keep motorcyclists and others safe while you're out on the road. Again, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org.